Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner and Board of Law Examiners of the State of Texas versus Stevens.
May it please the court, Mr. C. Robert Keith will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'm here today with Kevin Cole, my colleague who is a counsel paper. The basic issue in this case, the ultimate issue, is whether a reasonable person can conclude that an individual's 14-year failure to file federal income tax returns is evidence that that individual possesses character traits that are likely to result in injury to clients, obstruction of the administration of justice, or violations of code of conduct required of attorneys. We believe that merely to ask that question is to answer it. And if the answer is yes, as we believe that it clearly is, then the Court of Appeals in this case is in error. If I might give a very brief recitation of the facts, because I think the facts are very important here. The individual who sought licensing in this case, Mr. Stevens, has been licensed in the state of Mississippi as an attorney for many years. There are several persons that have attested to his character and his ability. There are no complaints or disciplinary proceedings pending against him in Mississippi. He filed an application for admission to the state bar in 1985, the State Bar of Texas. In that application, he reported the existence of some unsatisfied civil judgments against him. In the course of its investigation of this, and the judgments, by the way, are something that the board talked about and relied on, they're a part of this case, but they pale in comparison to the income tax issue, and so basically we're going to be talking about income tax, or we intend to talk primarily about the income tax issue. But in the course of its investigation, the board discovered that Mr. Stevens had not filed a federal income tax return since 1972.
You say they discovered that because he failed to reveal that information in his application?
Well, he did not reveal it in the application, but I don't think there's a space on the application to reveal it.
Doesn't the application require the applicant to list any debts, including student loans, which are more than 90 days past due? Would that be included within that, or?
Well, it certainly could. We had not focused on that, but I think that would be certainly a possibility. Because Mr. Stevens did owe taxes those years.
Is it part of your complaint that this was not reported, or are you saying that at least ambiguous?
Well, I think that the board could have found that. Certainly the standard here is whether a reasonable person could have made the conclusion that the failure to file and the facts that were before the board would permit one to conclude that this character trait would result in injury to clients, violation of the code, etc. It's any connection that a person could make is permissible and will uphold the judgment. It doesn't have to be the one the board made. The court can find it. The court could find that that's a reasonable conclusion. They could do it on that basis, even if that's not the one adopted by the board.
How do you discover that income tax is not
discovered? I think in this case it was discovered in the course of the investigation. There was correspondence from an attorney who was trying to collect the civil judgments against Mr. Stevens, and he had determined that, and he reported that, or it was in correspondence to the board. As best I can determine, that's
not a routine check.
That's correct.
So if Mr. Stevens had failed to list civil judgments, or let's assume he had no civil judgments outstanding against him, was there anything that he revealed in his application which would have disclosed to the board the existence of these unsatisfied tax debts?
Obviously, I can't say there's no way in the world it would have come up, but my thought is that had the civil judgments not existed and that investigation proceeded, the federal income tax issues would not have come up and would not have been discovered.
I guess my better way of asking my question is are the unsatisfied civil judgments what precipitated the hearing?
That's correct. And the initial hearings were scheduled on the unsatisfied civil judgments. There were some continuances, and in the course of investigation prior to the initial hearing was when the income tax issue arose, and then it was discussed at the hearing. Had the hearing proceeded earlier, presumably it would not have come up. Mr. Stevens' explanation for failing to file these income tax returns is that in 1972, or rather in 1973, he entrusted an accountant with his 1973 returns and his records, but the accountant didn't deliver, he didn't produce, and he didn't get the thing filed. Mr. Stevens got the records back. But by this time, he did not file. He said, basically, I was afraid to face up to the Internal Revenue Service, so he didn't file in 1973, or in 74, 75, or any time for the next 14 years. Now, about 1 year after applying for admission to the Texas Bar, he reconstructed his records and did file for 7 of the 14 missing years. Now, when he filed, he paid the taxes that he... In one place it reflects 86, in other places it suggests 87, but it's at least a year after the application was filed. And to be fair, Mr. Stevens indicated that he had talked to a tax attorney and had given records to a tax attorney to begin this, I believe in 1984, which was slightly before. The year before filing for Texas admission. When he filed, he paid the taxes that were due, that were shown to be due on the returns. The tax was fairly minimal. Two of the years, the total tax obligation is shown on the returns averaged $4,000. On the other 5 years, it was nominal, as low as $35 in a year to $175.
And he paid penalty and interest all for those years?
No, he did not. He left that for the Internal Revenue Service to compute, and at the time of the hearing, there was a dispute as to what the penalty and interest was, and that had not been paid. And the failure to file is a federal crime. It's punishable by year imprisonment, $25,000 fine, but no charges have been brought against Mr. Stevens. For whatever reason, the United States Attorney has not pursued prosecution, and there are 7 years that where no returns have been filed at all.
Has the statute of limitations run on those?
It is my understanding that the statute does not run on failure to file, you know, where you haven't filed. I know Mr. Stevens indicated that they chose 7 years because there's a 6 year, the IRS can go back 6 years, and so they went back 7. However, it is my understanding that on failure to file, that until you file, the statute doesn't run on those years.
It appears from Judge Smith's opinion that despite this significant failing, Mr. Stevens has had pretty good experience in the practice of law in Mississippi and seems to be held in high regard there.
There are letters in the file that where clients and friends and associates and people in the profession have attested to his character and to his ability. It is not clear that he has an extensive law practice, but all of those letters are faithful.
If it includes the president of the State Bar Association?
I believe that's correct. That was one of the persons who submitted a letter.
And is the Court of Appeals opinion correct that during the 20 years that he practiced law in Mississippi, he's never had a grievance filed against him?
That is correct.
Should not be accorded some weight here?
I think that's certainly something that the board and the courts can look at. I think everyone looks, in doing a substantial evidence review, I think we look at the entire record. However, I think it's not up to the courts to say, let's reweigh all these things. And put everything else in the balance and see how it comes out. The issue before the courts in a substantial evidence review is, could a reasonable person with all of this evidence, including the letters of recommendation and so forth, make the conclusion that it did? And we believe that the 14-year pattern is so overwhelming that that could produce that conclusion. And it's the conclusion that Mr. Stevens has a character trait that is likely to result in injury to a client, obstruction of the administration of justice, or violation of the Code of Professional Responsibility. And in fact, we believe that it is a trait that reflects dishonesty. One of the things that the court in Rule 2, and now it's been changed to Rule 4, this is the citation form that's used in the Court of Appeals opinion, but there's no substantive change in it. In Rule 2, it indicates that the sort of thing that's going to show the connection necessary for the board or the court to make that determination are character traits involving dishonesty or lack of trustworthiness in carrying out responsibility.
Did the investigation turn up any negative information relating to his law practice? The reason I ask that is because you're going under dishonesty, fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, sure. I presume, that approach. Well, as you pointed out, federal limitations don't begin to run until you have filed a return. If you don't file a return, that's neither fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, or even dishonesty. You simply fail to file a return. You have not complied with the requirement of filing one. And the federal government is privileged to come after you with an indictment into the prosecution, which for some reason, undisclosed to anyone, they have failed to do in this particular case. But is there anything related to his law practice that reflects negatively on this man's ability or character as a lawyer, exclusive of the income tax situation?
There was nothing in the record reflecting grievances or problems with the law practice. However, I would respectfully disagree that this does not show failure to file a return does not show dishonesty in this type situation. I think there are certainly situations where it does not, and I think that one can say the mere fact of failure to file a return does not constitute dishonesty. However,
was there a statement taken from the U.S. attorney as to why he wasn't prosecuting this gentleman?
No, Your Honor.
So, don't know.
I don't know.
Why they didn't think it was enough of a crime to go after.
Right. We can speculate it may be that he's not a big enough fish. The amount is not sufficient.
Maybe they're doing some work for the government. Maybe a traitor.
But the question, the converse of what Judge Gamich has asked, is there any evidence in this record that reflects on the trustworthiness or fitness of Mr. Stevens to practice as a lawyer other than this lengthy period in which he did not pay his taxes?
The basic evidence is the lengthy period of not paying the taxes, the unsatisfied civil judgments. There are a few other things that are in the record that the board looked at, they investigated, they may deal with honesty, but perhaps youth board discretion, and the board did not base its decision on that. But the failure to file a return, the government says if you make X amount of income, you are required under penalty of law to file a return. If you don't file a return, you're telling the government, I didn't make that much income. Mr. Stevens did. And further, if you don't file a return, and the reason is I was afraid to face up, so I stopped filing so no one would find out. It's not so much the initial act, it's not the problem of being late, it's covering it up.
And why don't
for 14 years
begin to run when you fail to file timely?
Well, I don't believe the limitations began to run on the liability because you haven't reported, is my understanding. I would have to look and separately brief the limitations period for you, Your Honor.
Might be interested in.
Okay.
Counsel, the people who made laudatory references for Mr. Stevens, is there anything in the record that shows that they knew that he had failed to file his tax return for 14 years?
No, Your Honor, there is not. And in fact, in the cases you look at around the country, and there are some, they're cited in the briefs, there's a New York case, for example. You have situations where people do not file their tax returns, they get into trouble, and there are people that testify this is a good person, he's done a good job as a lawyer. Because you don't go around and tell everybody, you don't broadcast the fact that I'm not filing my income tax returns. People aren't going to know it. It's something that's going on outside of your normal life that people see. So I don't think there's any indication that anyone knew that. Perhaps in the later one someone did, but it obviously was not a publicly broadcast situation. But the things that we believe that it is dishonest and shows dishonesty, particularly when considered on the 14-year pattern. If you look at Sherman, the New York case that's cited, and obviously this is not a presidential case here, but it goes to show what a reasonable person could conclude. And in Sherman, they said, this person we find is motivated by venality and dishonesty. There's a lot of money involved in Sherman. Sherman was a man of substantial means. Mr. Stevens is a man of modest means. But that's not why they found venality and dishonesty. What they say is, we find dishonesty based on the 20-year pattern, or as evidenced by the 20-year pattern of not filing. It's the continuation. If it happened once, if it happened twice, maybe there are excuses. If it happens 14 times or 20 times, then you're being dishonest. The other thing is, if it's a pattern, and we go over to Rule 8.04 of the Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct, you can be disciplined for committing a serious crime or other criminal acts that reflects adversely on honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. This is not a serious crime. By the way, we think the Court of Appeals used the wrong standard. They said you have to prove a serious crime. The rule doesn't say that. It's a serious crime or other crime, that is a non-serious crime, that fits those criteria. And if you look down to the comment indicates we think what is precisely the situation here, which is a pattern of repeated offenses, even ones of minor significance when considered separately, can indicate a difference to legal obligations that legitimately could call a lawyer's overall fitness to practice into question. That's what's going on here. And I think that here we have a person who missed the initial deadline, who didn't file in 1973, but the problem was going forward in 74 and 5 and 80 and on, and not filing, covering up, and staying out of the system. And that was the problem. And it wasn't a hard problem. It wasn't one that, you know, he has to come up with $500,000. And that's the tragedy, that he could not fit his own or take care of his own legal obligations, and now we're being asked to license him.
Mr. Heath, I have a question with regards to the facts in this case. He did not file income tax returns for 14 years. Right. However, they reconstructed 7 of those years, and he did file for 7 years?
That's correct.
So there are 7 years still outstanding. He has not filed tax returns on
that? That's correct. Those are the first, as I understand, those are the first 7 of the 14 are
And as to the unsatisfied judgments, are they still outstanding?
Under the state of the record, they still are. So something has happened.
He has not updated or submitted additional information to the board saying these judgments have been satisfied?
There is none, no such information that I'm aware of, and it's my understanding they are not.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Nikolai von Chrysler will present an argument for the respondent.
Counsel, when your client decided to straighten up his act and go back, why did he just go back 7 years? Why didn't he really try to clean up the whole thing and pay it all?
I don't know. What the record said was that he worked for a while for the federal government, for the engineers. And had withholding, I mean, money had been withheld to pay the taxes. Why he didn't go back beyond that, I don't know.
Would you run you mean, now, is that when he started working for the federal government and they started withholding, is that when he decided to go back and take 7 years? Or went back to the point where they did withhold?
I think he went back to the point, I think going back 7 years would get him to the point when he was, or at least near to the point that he was working for the, I can't remember the name of the engineers, but the Corps of Engineers. Levees and so forth. Mississippi, Louisiana, right. Yes, sir.
But he didn't go back to try to clean up his whole record with the with the Internal Revenue Service. He just went back and cleaned up part of it.
No, he'd hired a man who was a tax lawyer named Hamilton Jones. Hamilton Jones was dealing with the IRS for him. And so they filed these different returns, and there was some dispute at the end as to how much penalties or interest he should pay for the last 2 or 3 years of this. But by the time this was going on, he had paid. He had contacted Mr. Jones prior to the time, 2 years prior to the time he'd filed his application for the Board of
Well, now, was this after he came to Texas and decided he wanted to get a license in Texas? Or was this occur in Mississippi?
It was before, yes, sir, in Mississippi before that.
But when he came to Texas and applied here, is he practicing law here now?
I don't know, sir.
What kind of work is he in?
He said that he had not made much money, but he'd done a little personal injury work, and he'd done condemnations. He had a part of the exhibits were a case that he'd taken to the Fifth Circuit and had to do, I think, with condemnation law.
Since he's been in Texas?
No, sir. He's never been in Texas. He's never practiced law in Texas. He's physically speaking to Lexington or down in Mississippi.
Oh, he's still in Mississippi even now, but he just wants to get a law license in Texas.
Correct.
Does she have any outstanding tax liability today?
When the record stopped, this Mr. Jones was negotiating with the IRS on what they were arguing about penalties and interest on what I want to say was 2 or maybe 3 of the last years of this. But the record showed that he had paid taxes for 7 different checks for different years for paying taxes.
In other words, the IRS is not pursuing him for any unpaid taxes at this time or at the time of his application, but they are negotiating on penalties and interest that the IRS believes.
Well, that was in 1986, whenever this hearing was at the Board of Bar Exams. I don't know the status of that. He never had a tax lien.
As of the time he made this application, though, that was the situation, that they were not pursuing him for any unpaid tax principal, but they were negotiating interest and penalties that were due.
That was the last tail end of the negotiations, was an argument about how much penalties he should pay.
The IRS was not pursuing him for any unpaid tax principal at that time.
As far as I know, that's correct. And he introduced tax returns, and he introduced into the record the copies of the checks.
So for whatever reason, he did not file returns for those 14 years. That issue has been resolved with the Internal Revenue Service, with the exception at the last time of the negotiation that you're aware of, except for unpaid interest and penalties.
It had been resolved up to that point in 1986. I expect it's been resolved totally.
1986.
That's when the hearing was.
You said 96.
No, sir. 1986 is when the hearing was at the Board of Bar Exams. The chronology is he applies in 86 and has a hearing, but he goes to the tax lawyer in 84.
Is this information available to the Board of Law Examiners at that time, or how far did they pursue their investigation?
Well, they asked him, there was an affidavit from Mr. Jones, they asked him, that was a lot of what the examination was about, the questions asked him at the hearing.
Money had been withheld from his paycheck for taxes. He had not filed returns for a number of those years.
That's correct. And what his testimony about that was that he had given in 1973 or 74, this was when he first started working at the Corps of Engineers, he had given his materials to do his routine annual tax to a CPA whose name I don't remember right now. And the CPA kept them for more than a year, and then Mr. Stevens was now 2 years where he hadn't filed tax returns. So it was inadvertent. When he started, it was inadvertent. There was certainly no motive to not pay. He was trying to do that.
That was 1974?
Well, that gets... Yes, in 74, 75, or early on. And then after that, of course, it's the part that if I were looking at, this is what I'd look at, that now you get your stuff back. Why don't you go do something about it? And the answer to that was I was scared and I didn't know what to say.
What is the penalty if the government's got your money but you haven't filed your returns? I understand it for their bookkeeping purposes, it might be handy, but where's the crime?
I don't know. There's a statute which, needless to say, standing up here, I can't remember the number, but it's the federal willful non-filing 7246, something that's cited in his brief.
Assuming the government's got all the money they're entitled to through withholding anyway.
If you, being with the IRS, as you can imagine, it's pretty hard. If you pay and then don't give them the right information.
We're all aware of that.
That's right. And it's not just a matter of not paying, but also...
We take judicial notice of that,
Council,
but how many years of 14 were taxes were there?
I have a record. I want to say that they worked for at least 5 years for the Corps of Engineers.
So 5 of 14.
Yes.
And it's your understanding it was the...
And it's withholding.
But that was in the 70s rather than the 80s.
73.
Okay, so for 5 years, when he initially began not filing returns, they might have been withheld, but then after that, there was a number of years where no taxes were.
Yes, ma'am. He testified that he had withholding, as you can imagine, from his paycheck.
I'm trying to calculate these numbers in my head. From 73 to 78, he worked for the Corps of Engineers, that five-year period. Money was withheld monthly from his paycheck.
Correct.
Or withholding for taxes. He did not file returns even after he left the Corps of Engineers until, I presume, 1985 or so. It's when they went back 7 years, back to the time he left the Corps of Engineers, apparently.
I don't want to say that the thought was to go back to that time because I can't remember what the dates are exactly on this, but they went back.
In some proximity to it.
Well, there was testimony that 6 years was the statute of limitations, so they went back 7 years. And
whatever your recollection of the facts is, and whatever ours might be, you have no problem with being tied to the record that was developed in front of the Board of Law Examiners. And you agree that under the substantial evidence review standard, we do not do a de novo review of what they heard. We have to see whether there's substantial evidence to support the Board of Law Examiners' decision.
Right.
You agree with that? One other thing, Rule 8.04, Mr. Stevens would not have to have committed a crime under subdivision A3, would he?
No.
In other words, number two, A2 talks about committing a crime, serious crime or other criminal act. A3 talks about engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation.
My first point to you on my prepared presentation, which is now going to be on this very set.
Okay.
And the point that I'm making is you can't read just what the Board of Bar Examiners puts up there. You have to see this in the context of the comments 4 and 5, of which they have part of the comments 5. There's a totality. The DRA, as the lawyer, can't do two things. One is to commit a serious crime, and the other is any other criminal act. Right? If you drop way down to Part B, it would tell you that a serious crime is a felony involving moral turpitude, misdemeanor, involving theft, embezzlement, fraud, and supply chain.
Can we agree that this is not a serious crime? You don't contend it was a serious crime.
I don't. The Court of Appeals didn't. The McVickers cast that.
Okay. So what other?
It's in this category, other criminal act.
Okay.
So then you look at the rules, the comments 4 and 5, which is this is part of 5. And comment 4 says that many kinds of legal conduct reflect adversely on fitness to practice law. However, some kinds of offenses carry no such implication. But meaning, of course, obviously, there's some circumstances in not filing tax returns. Sometimes maybe it wouldn't. And what's the guideline? And so it goes on to say, traditionally in this state, the distinction's been drawn in terms of serious crimes and other offenses. That's not too dumb. These rules continue that distinction by making only those criminal offenses either amounting to serious crimes or, here's the language, or having the salient characteristics of such crimes the subject of this. So what the bar should focus and concern itself with is whether the any other criminal act that they want to say is not filing these tax returns by Mr. Stevens, does that have the salient characteristics of a serious crime? That's to me kind of the test of this.
You don't think it could their decision could be supported on the basis of 804A3? If we were to conclude that he is not guilty of a criminal act, or if we agree with you that there's not substantial evidence that he committed a crime, could the board decision still be affirmed on the basis of A3?
Here's why I would want to argue for my client that he could not. The intent, the thing that's in common with the serious crimes, meaning the felony involving moral turpitude or misdemeanors involving theft, embezzlement, fraudulent misrepresentation, is that there's an evil intent to do something to somebody. And that's what Mr. Chervin in this New York case that was mentioned a minute ago did. He was found, the board or the court there made a finding that he was motivated by greed and profit motive, and that he was, there are a lot of sections to it, but he didn't pass the good heart test by any manner whatsoever. He was trying not to pay taxes to support his lifestyle, and that's pretty much what it says in there. When Mr. Stevens said...
Do we have evidence as to why he wasn't paying taxes? Why your client wasn't paying taxes?
He said he was scared, and my word for it is that he's in denial.
He's what?
He's in denial. That's my word for it.
In denial.
And I
14 years in denial.
Well, it can last for...
Every year a lifetime.
But it's a dozen
times. Isn't this a...
But this is still deceit or misrepresentation.
No, it's not foul. It's not deceit or misrepresentation. If you wanted to put a label on him for a character, you might say he was weak-minded or he was scared or something. But I don't think you could say that he was dishonest or he was misleading. And that's the difference between him and Mr. Chervin, the New York lawyer, that was not paying taxes to enrich himself and to cheat the government and to make money.
Well, in all seriousness, can we have lawyers licensed to practice in the state who are afraid of confronting the tribunal?
I'm afraid of the IRS, and we'll stand here and admit it, but at least we're paying taxes.
Well, if you're hired to represent a client before the IRS, I presume you will oppose the IRS before the appropriate tribunal, won't you?
I would stand up proudly and say to Mr. Stevens, what the IRS has to show is that he willfully and intentionally meant to not file. And what Mr. Stevens' testimony was that he explained why he didn't file. He was giving his papers to the CPA, his name, I don't remember, he kept it for a year and a half.
That was for 2 years, right?
That's correct. So the start of what his problem was, it's like everybody else has been filed tax returns, there's some reason for it in their minds that gets them to do it unless they're just frauds and cheats, which Mr. Stevens was. And as time goes by, I can laugh through it 14 years, and how long does the denial go on? But I think that's what the scenario is.
Isn't this a Zoe Baird issue where there is disrespect for the law and hesitancy to entrust someone who is charged to follow the law and enforce the law?
You know, and another part of my prepared text is going to be to make this an illustration that I've spent weeks thinking about. I could sit here and be fat and overweight and have a bad diet and not do any exercise and have four kids and not have a will, plus take contingency cases. And my wife would say that I'm financially irresponsible and I kind of have to agree to it, but I don't think anybody would say that I shouldn't be a lawyer. Where I can owe fines to the public library or violate the leash law by letting my dog roam everywhere.
Well, I don't know of any statute that requires you to make
No, it's not a statute.
I'm not talking about the inability to pay the judgments or financial irresponsibility, but it seems to me it shows a blatant disrespect for the law that all the people who are not lawyers are bound to obey.
Doesn't look good. I'm not trying to, my job isn't to minimize or erase away this stuff. My job is to say that what that Board of Bar Examiners is obligated to do is to follow the law and look to see if the intent is there. And there's evidence that you can weigh in various ways.
So well, you're really judge intent by what somebody does. Don't we, in a criminal case, if someone shoots someone and they say, oh, I didn't intend to, well, you know, you pulled the trigger, you did it.
But maybe you were aiming at the deer and you hit the hunter.
Well, there are a lot of lawyers that better hope that we don't enforce 804A3 when it comes to representations and reliance on authority, we get some of the briefs in this court.
You know, my remark about the violating, racking up public library funds, lease laws, you can put the label disrespect to the law, but that's not as bad, obviously, as my filed last returns now. But conceptually speaking, you can put a label on me of disrespect for the law. But that doesn't mean that now, because there is a logical connection between a person that disrespects the law and the likelihood of professional misconduct, that doesn't mean that that's the analysis that the board should make or the court should make. The board's court needs to review the substantial evidence and the facts that underlie the label that is put on me. And so you wouldn't throw me out of the bar, I hope, for having a library account. And I got
you contend, as I understand it, that the board would have to find that his conduct over this 14 years would be likely to cause harm.
That was what the Court of Appeals said. And
that's what the Court of Appeals said. The Board of Law Examiners contends that misreads Rule 2B, which focuses not on the conduct, but on the character trait.
Right.
And the board said that his character traits, as established by this conduct, disqualified it. Can you explain why you disagree with that contention, that character traits are key rather than the conduct he engaged in?
I'm saying just the opposite. I'm saying that the conduct is the key, and the board is saying the character traits are the key.
Are you relying on the wording of any rule for that argument?
No, I'm relying on the argument that if the board can say that I'm financially responsible because of violating the Austin lease law and the library fines I racked up, therefore, because I'm financially responsible, I should not have a license. What state legitimate interest does that serve? Where is it not arbitrary and capricious to jump from a label to a logical, but not necessarily a fair conclusion? If the worst I've done is get parking tickets when I go to the Travis County Courthouse because I'm too lazy to walk. There has to be some kind of standard. And the standard, I think, is the way I'm reading the Rule 804 misconduct that looks to the intent. If my financial irresponsibility or my disrespect for the law were grounded in the salient characteristics of a serious crime, defined as, in this case, a misdemeanor that involves an uncalled man, well, then I'd say, okay, here's my bar card, and I can't stand up here and argue. But if I do it for different reasons, if there's not the possible of the degree of the man chief concealing to it, then I don't think it is such a crime that the bar can punish you.
So if you didn't pay your taxes because you were trying to put your kids through college, or?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'll be glad to travel.
Because you were giving it to the church? Or?
No. Not even.
What is it?
I'm not remotely suggesting that. I'm overstepping my evidence pretty majorly. Keep making my film.
What's the good motive?
I don't think there's a good motive. I think there's an absence of bad motive.
As long as you don't have a black heart?
Mr. Sherbin, yes, sir, in that case, Mr. Sherbin was sitting there and made $480,000 the last year when they finally got him, and he wasn't paying me. He was talking about his lifestyle. He fessed up that he thought this was the same moral equivalent to thievery and so forth. Mr. Stevens, he could say it worse. Should have done it. He didn't do it, but he wouldn't have asked him.
Perhaps compared to Mr. Kirby, Mr. Stevens is not nearly so bad off. Let me ask you, though, about under the ABA Model Code of Professional Conduct, and I'll just ask you the question if you'd like to perhaps think about it, if you don't have an immediate answer, and submit any supplemental authorities you'd like. Under Rule 804, Comment 1, the Texas rule differs, or the comment actually under 1 differs from the ABA Model Code. The ABA Model Code says, Comment 1, many kinds of illegal conduct reflect adversely on fitness to practice law, such as offenses involving fraud, and the offense of willful failure to file an income tax return.
That's laying it out.
That comment apparently was not adopted in a comment in Texas. Do you have any contention in that regard as to why that was?
Well, on my surface potential abatement, but isn't it in Texas code? You need to follow Texas law. I'm not saying the Texas law is the best there is, or this sort of model code should be adopted.
Unless it was subsumed within these other broader requirements?
That's what I think is the question.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.
Is there any significance to what Justice Cornyn just addressed, that the ABA model code specifically sets out failure to file income tax returns as an offense, and that Texas Code of Professional Conduct, which adopts many of the ABA provisions specifically, does not incorporate that one, or if it does, where is it subsumed in our code?
I don't know what the rationale of leaving that out was, Your Honor. However, the situation here is not so much the failure to file. If Mr. Stevens had failed to file income tax returns in 1973 and then had taken care of it in 74 or 75 and gotten straight with the Internal Revenue Service, I can't imagine that any of us would be here today. The problem that Mr. Stevens has is not that he failed to file, it's that he failed to file for 14 years. It's the pattern of conduct, it's the character trait, it's the continued cover-up and evasion of responsibility. That's what the problem is. It's not a simple failure to file.
What did the investigation disclose as to, I'd like the chronology and the calendar sequence of events here. He worked for the Corps of Engineers from, what, 73 to 78, withholding, federal withholding was taken, worked for the federal government, federal withholding was taken out of the paycheck, failed to file for all of those years. At some point around 1978, left the employ of the federal government, presumably went into private practice, didn't pay his quarterlies, didn't file his annuals, for another 7 years. Or 7 or 8 years thereabout. Finally, well before the time he applied for admission to the Texas Bar, began negotiating with IRS for payment of back taxes.
And well, this is what I'm trying
to get at. What are the facts
all
here?
Number one, in 1973, his return was being prepared by the tax attorney. That's approximately the time he went to the Corps of Engineers, worked for the Corps of Engineers. If he worked for 5 years, actually it comes out to 77 if you take the years inclusive.
Was he a lawyer at that time?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. He was. And there is a year or two period then when he's in private practice, or actually much longer than that, when he goes back and pays and files returns. It takes years, he files for years that he has been in private practice, he omits some years that he has been in private practice, he omits the Corps of Engineer years. Now, during the Corps of Engineer time, he was having taxes withheld. Whether those were sufficient to meet his tax obligations, I don't know. There's no way to know unless he files a return. And the burden is on him to do that. So he may or may not have met his tax obligations, I don't know, presumably in the years. I would assume that he had income when he wasn't working for the Corps of Engineers and wasn't having taxes withheld. I am not sure that he began, there's nothing in the record to indicate that he began negotiating with the Internal Revenue Service before he filed with the Texas Bar. He consulted a tax attorney in 1984. The tax attorney filed, reconstructed those years, filed the returns in 1986 or 87. And they're conflicting references in the record, but it's one of those 2 years. He filed in 85. So I suspect the negotiations began when they were ready to file.
He applied to the State Bar in 85.
That's correct.
So he had already consulted the tax attorney in 84.
He had consulted the tax attorney, presumably.
Don't know when negotiations actually began with IRS.
There is no evidence about negotiations with the Internal
Revenue Service. The returns were filed in 86 or 87.
In 86 or 87, that's correct, after filing with State Bar.
But one point here is, of course, he's apparently seeking to, has sought to rectify his situation. There's no
there any evidence really showing that since the last hearing before the board? That's probably this obviously wouldn't be the record.
I don't know.
No problem with IRS that you know of since the last 6 years.
Well, I don't know anything beyond the hearing, which was in 1988, was when the hearing was. We've talked something about Mr. Sherman. You know, all the cases that deal with failure to file involve discipline of the attorney, not always disbarment, but there is discipline. Sherman is an individual where the board, or actually it wasn't the board, it was the New York Supreme Court Appellate Division, the intermediate appellate court there, that found the disbarment was required. Mr. Sherman was a very wealthy man, or certainly had substantial means and a substantial income, and he was not paying a lot of taxes. He profited. But I think the key point to the New York court was that he didn't file for 20 years. That's the same thing. We contend the law is the same for rich and for poor.
Is there any different standard between a lawyer that's already in taxes or practicing as Mr. Sherman was in, and one is in another state actively practicing in there that he really wants to make money? Is there any more due process entitlement or like, or do we look at each applicant?
Well, certainly on due process, you know, someone who already has a license and you're taking that property right away is, I think, in a different due process posture than someone who is applying for a license.
Right, because this is not a due process case.
Right. Well, I think it is not the same sort of due process as a license revocation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause, and the court will take another recess.
Please rise.